Any variety. The cafe.
Non-powder, non-powder.
Constitute, already constitute.
What is it already constitute?
Yeah. So that was the major flaw.
Okay, if everybody can, as you ask questions, just introduce yourselves. I'm gonna come in at some point and give you five, and that's when we're gonna shut down. Okay, so.
At five, not at zero.
Yeah.
I'm Lauren from MediaMikes.com.
Hello.
I'm Liz from Real News Daily.
Liz Kaufman from Mary Sue.
Tara Robinson, The Daily Quirk.
Kevin O'Keefe, Mike.com.
Carla Hay, Examiner.com.
Melanie Vota, Real Life with Jane.
Everybody? I'm Desi Van Til.
I'm Diana Agron.
I'm Sean Musha.
I'm Jason Sudeikis. From Tumble really? Down.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Did you ever have a famous figure that you would have had a singular obsession with the way Andrew did in the film with Hunter?
I had that with Olivia Wilde currently.
Good thing.
Yeah. It's not difficult. I think musically. I go through like obsessions here and there, but I would say I've had my Frank Sinatra phase, which actually was brought into through Harry Connick Jr. because my cousins got his album We Are in Love, and I buy everything of his. I love that. I think that guy's great. And then I dabbled in that area. My mom got me into musicals, but Ben Folds has been a consistent one throughout my.
I had a Ben Folds.
Yeah, that was a big one. I would sort of always refer to him as like my musical older brother, like, where I didn't really get it. He's like a couple years older than me. You get the album, and then you sort of listen to it, and you're like, oh, I like the songs, I like his voice, I love the instrumentation, and then cut to like. 3 years later, I put on the CD on the iPod or whatever medium, and they'll be like, oh, wait a minute, oh, he like, get that one. But nothing that would have lasted the desire to write a book about, So that's where Andrew and I differ.
And can you talk about crafting these original songs? Because I'm wondering how long did you get to live with the songs, as your character before you started filming? And
well, that's the funny thing. I think we planned on that. We planned to have the songs. In fact, we were going after musicians while we were trying to make the film over the course of years, because we imagined that we'd get a great musician to record an album for us, and then that would help us get the movie made, in a sense, like it's going to be about this artist, and so here's that voice. But it just played out that we couldn't get anybody to commit. I mean, in talking to a lot of the musicians, they said they had trouble figuring out sort of where their music ended and the music of Hunter would begin. Do you want me to sound like myself? Am I putting on a voice? Am I doing something else? So anyway, we ended up getting Damien Jurado to commit to doing the film while we were in pre-production. And he was on tour with this great last album of his, so he didn't have time to record anything for us before we went on set. The great thing is there are these wonderful musicians who we were imagining who, while Desi was writing the screenplay, we could listen to them on set. And then I think it worked out even better because Damien could then watch the film after we'd shot it and sort of take his inspiration and create his character in resonance with the characters that these guys created on set. He could watch Rebecca Hall and fall in love with his wife and write songs for her. I mean, it was funny that when Damien was in the middle of writing it while we were in post-production, he was watching the movie in character as Hunter, and we had some conversation where he was like, yeah, man, I like the movie a lot, but I'm kind of like pissed at Hannah right now because she's with this other guy. I'm like, you can't do that from beyond the grave. You can't have that perspective.
You didn't know that when you were writing the song.
No.
She hadn't moved on yet.
Yeah, I know now.
Yeah, so it was Hunter from Beyond the Grave that wrote these songs.
It's why that song from the album that's on the movie Fuck Andrew makes no sense.
The bang of the song, too, but you just can't include
it. It was Fuck Andrew, parentheses, don't.
It was hip-hop based, it was beautiful.
Definitely a radio hit.
Yeah.
I don't know.
There's a really interesting line between exploitation and fandom. and like in journalistic responsibility. So you, I mean, all of you explore that in one way or another in the film. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was, where did it come from? So I agree. It's there, we do, and I thought it was cool.
Well, I'd be interested to actually hear what you guys on your end of the table would say to that. But, you know, Andrew, I think, absolves himself from any ickiness or feeling of being too predatory because he's coming from it from an academic approach,
right,
where he's trying to not just understand somebody, but canonize and make sure that, you know, the speech that he gives to Hannah in the diner about, I'm trying to build the monument that raises him up above the rubble, that there's so much noise, there's so much music, there's so much mediocrity, and that he feels that this voice, and not just the, you know, the physical voice, but like the poetic voice that was prematurely lost, you know, was not just a personal loss for his fans, but for a cultural collective loss. And so I think he feels a responsibility the way that a journalist would feel responsible to tell the story and make sure that it perpetuates. But
there's a good journalist that would last a long time.
A good journalist that would.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
As opposed to being the sort of person that Hannah has been contending with, which is a person looking mostly for gossip. Thank you. Looking for gossip and looking for dirt and looking for a flash in the pan nugget that can be on a website for 2 seconds and get hits and then move along. You know, he's trying, just like Hunter was trying to build music that was timeless, Andrew is trying to write something about this person whom he reveres that is also going to stand the test of time and write the book.
And that's what's interesting with Diana's character, because she was always, you know, the idea that we had for her, we didn't want her to be like some disposable other girl. You feel like the character that you play of Finley is such sort of emblematic of like the faster moving life in the city, and she works for a record label. It doesn't come through in the film sort of as cut quite as clearly as it was loomed in the script. There were some things that we had to pare down for time, but she comes up there. I think it's clear. How did it strike you when she appears? We sort of know why she comes up there, right? Like, you can see that she latches on to the idea that there's a song that she needs to curate.
Yeah.
And I feel like it was this feeling of like, as the outsider, she wants to make it hers. She wants to be the one who like brings it to the world and almost wants to jump over Andrew and not let him do it. So
that stuff's in there in that scene when I come back, you know, after Hannah rebuffs Andrew, you know, we're hanging out at our apartment with our friends, and then you're like, I'm like, you know, like Finley's sort of saying, who gives a crap about this guy? Like, I see dudes like this all the time, and I'm like, no, but he's not like, you know.
Well, that's the thing. I feel like in this day and age, it takes a personal courage to take a stand on someone and say, this one deserves to be thought of as great, not just another musician, but
not just popular, but great.
Right. This one is somebody that should be listened to and will be listened to in perpetuity, which was a big challenge in trying to get the music right. That's a really high bar to set.
Yeah, but yeah, when you're name-checking, you know, we were saying last night, like, Nick Drake and Jeff Buckley and Kurt Cobain, and then here you are inventing this guy and putting him in the same regard. I mean, you know, I know it's like, you know.
It's terrifying.
It's terrifying, and I guarantee you, any of the people that we spoke to prior to Damien, as I said you know, the other night, would, I mean, I know if I was being asked to play, you know, like, whatever, like, The Funniest Man on Earth, and that's the name of the movie, I'd be like, oh, no. I got that move, but
it's a little intimidating.
A little fear, but yeah, it has to be a fear-based decision. It's like, where do I begin? Where do I end? Like, that all sounds like, you know, past mumbo jumbo. But
yeah, when you're claiming that someone is a musical genius, and then you produce music that might be just so-so.
Yeah.
That's sort of that was the fear, and the thing that actually felt really good last night was how many people approached us afterwards and said, I completely understood why, you know, Andrew was obsessed, or you understand. I don't know how you guys all felt, but it seemed like the response to the music has been really positive. Mm-hmm.
Did you, with the character of Andrew's obsession with Hunter, did you think it first came from this connection to suicide, or that he put the suicide assumption on because of his love for the music? Mm.
That's an interesting
little
chicken and egg.
Little column A, column B, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I personally, I think like a good song is one that when you're just recently in love or just deeply in love, it's the happiest song in the world, and then you listen to the same song after, you know, he or she breaks your heart, and you're just like, oh, this is fucking horrible. This song. You hear cover versions of it, you're like, oh, come on, Dixie Chicks, I don't need this now. Not you guys, not you too. And I mean, I could see that it's that little handshake you have with certain art when it finds you at a certain time with a certain, coming from a certain place. I would assume as, you know, pretending to be this guy for a little bit, that he definitely liked the music, but then, boy, did it jump up a lot when the unfortunate thing happened. And I think there maybe is that layer on there. Because I think Andrew is like a, you know, he wants to be an artist, but probably is a little bit too scared to do so.
Yeah, it's not like your obsession or your interest in Hunter Miles began after his death.
No.
That you listened to him and you had discovered him the way and the time the rest of the sort of it rippled out to the rest of the, you know.
But that is one of the things that we were interested in exploring, is why is it that when an artist, even though somebody who only has one album, passes away, then suddenly they become more interesting in some way. And, you know, Hannah going through this very, very personal pain that she has to address on the public stage. And it's something that Desi was investigating because she grew up in this small town where the story is set. And when there was a loss in that small town, it resonated throughout the whole community and everybody felt it. And in a sort of microcosm way, not the way in which it works in the movie, but I know that the people who felt the pain the most had to address the fact that all of their friends suddenly saw them as people who were hurt and people who had lost someone. And we were interested in trying to understand what that means when it's on the world stage. Suddenly, everybody in the world knows you as the widow, and they're coming after you for what the widow knows. And you don't even get to be human anymore. You can't experience the pain in a private way.
Yeah, you become like almost like a symbol for whatever pain and loss they go through. I mean, that's what I, you know, that's what I was putting on Hannah. You know?
Mm-hmm. Right, and I think that the pathos that was already in Hunter's music, and the sort of longing and the aching that drew Andrew to him, you know, even before his tragedy on the mountain. I think that, you know, that's sort of what the handshake probably was that, you know, because Andrew's character had gone through this pain, and so, you know, there's previous drafts where when Andrew and Anna are fighting at the end, you know, where she just says something like, you know, you're looking through the world through these shit-covered glasses, and that is the sort of cynicism that she's accusing him of, and it doesn't mean that his love of the music is cynical, it just means that whatever is kind of that dark, aching part of longing. I mean, look, Andrew and Hunter had a kind of mojo just in the same way that Hannah and Andrew do, because they both fell for the same man.
The idea of obsession, obviously Andrew has it, but Hannah has it as well, and they're very different. They both want to make this man immortal, but for very different reasons and in very different ways. Can you guys just talk about how difficult it was to sort of portray the same feeling, but through two very different lenses, since it's so core to the film?
I'll just start with that, which is that before I even knew exactly what Andrew wanted out of his trip to Maine, like the character started having these conversations, and all I really knew, one of the first things that I knew that the film would be about was about a woman who was trying to keep her late husband alive through the impossible task of encapsulating his life into a book that she would never actually want to finish. Because as soon as you finish a book like that, even though you think intellectually that you might, then you know that you wrap it up and you finish it and then you put it away and it's on the shelf and it's this thing that's finished. I think a bound copy of Hunter Miles' biography would be like a really horrible thing for her to have, actually. I think what she wanted was the process. And she wanted an excuse. I know from experience that sometimes when you're missing somebody and it actually feels really good to just dive down that whole of loss and just looking at, you know, looking at items, looking at photographs, and just sort of surrounding yourself with memory. And then if she had this book, there was a legitimacy to it, there was a reason to it. You know, she's a PhD in English, she's a bright woman, she's spent a lot of time thinking intellectually about this pursuit. And this way she sort of absolves herself of any feeling of I'm doing anything creepy or weird. I'm writing a book. I have to do this research. Right. So that certainly was how Hannah got into it. Mm. We can talk about the other side of it if you wish. But
No, I think that describes it very well, just the fact that it's like, I'm sorry.
No, please. Yeah, you're not like, what are you doing? Okay, like,
did I play Andrew or did you?
There's some framings of certain shots, yeah. I can't tell. And there's a couple times you did play Andrew.
Yeah. And Joe maybe.
Yeah. Oh, Joe, yeah, sorry, yeah. Joe did too. Yeah.
I was the second level for Joe.
Yeah. Yeah. Could you talk about your perspective? Because you've seen both sides of the music industry. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you've seen how something that may have been perceived as a cult hit turns into something very mainstream and, you know, well accepted. And I was wondering how that informed how you played this character, considering that there's been a lot of, you know, coverage and talk about how people don't want to buy music anymore, but there are obviously, you know, things that have come out that have proven that wrong. So what was your perspective as someone who's been on tour, recorded music, and now you're point in time, the music industry, what's your perspective?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, I mean, I grew up with, like, cassettes and things like that, you know what I mean? And records, and then CDs, and then all of these things. And just knowing how much, like, love and dedication goes into all this. And if you think about it, like, as an art form, music is one of the things that will move people beyond a film, beyond a book, beyond so many other things, because it's so tangible. You could listen to it all day long in your time of want or need or happiness or all of these things, and the sense memory that comes along with a song is so overwhelmingly powerful, like almost as powerful as smell, you know. So I think that it's, you know, for a character like this, for a movie like this, it makes sense to have that obsession with somebody and that connection to somebody and want and need to kind of go through it. And as far as, you know, all these things with Spotify and Tidal and this and that and whatever, mm-hmm. I don't know, like, I think for artists, it's kind of sad days because, you know, if you want to be an indie artist in any perspective, almost nobody's, you're having to fight, you know, hand and tooth for money from anybody. And then, you know, if you're involved in a big project, you're still having to fight and tooth for even just a small increment of more money. It's just everything is hard for artists right now in a way that I don't think, you know, in 10 years of doing this, I've never seen it as hard as it is right now. So I don't know if that changes or...
But it's interesting what you said about people, that the music means more and people use music emotionally. Mm. I think that's maybe why, you know, the public is acting as if music should be free. Like, it feels so personal. It connects with me, and I should... It's not really about the artist so much as my connection to it. Mm. And it's just... easy to grab it and take it.
Yeah, and then on the other side of things, you know, if you're not playing arenas, if you're an indie artist that, you know, is relying solely on your music being bought online, you're not gonna, you know, you're not making any money. So it's interesting.
And it's partially interesting about Damien Jurado too. The man has been around for years. He has 11 albums that he's recorded, and he's kind of like been background noise. You'll hear him. But, like, personally, I never actually attached a name to who that was. I'd heard these songs, and I almost think I thought that they were from different artists, because he changes his sound over the course of the last decade a lot in these different... But I loved a song from every different era, and that was one of the exciting things about using him in this film, is I feel like we want audiences to discover him and feel like that sounds familiar in some way, but I can't attach a name to it so that he can take on this persona.
It was also helpful that, you know, Damien had a voice that was character perfect for the film, mm-hmm. and had the, you know, as you frequently say, like that wounded, you know, he's like, it's a masculine voice, it's a sexy voice, but it's still like a broken and wounded voice, which makes sense for, you know, that to hold for Andrew to connect to. But it also is not a voice where you hear it and you're like, oh, I can picture Tom York sitting, you know, recording this. Like, it's a person who has a bit of mystery behind him. You're like, well, where did that come from? So you can kind of sell, you know, we hope that the movie, you know, can portray or convince you that there is this, or was this musician, tortured soul, recording albums in a little boathouse on a remote lake in Maine, mm-hmm. and that this voice would, you know, naturally emanate from such a situation, such a place.
You also have a lot of comedic stuff, like you get a lot of like extra lines, and I was wondering if that was all in the page or if you added that. Or...
I mean, there is, anything that was added is all sort of based on what was already there. I mean, I wouldn't know the percentage of it, you know, but, you know, I mean, I don't know. You would know because
we know. Can I tell you something? Yeah. We always there are like two, maybe three moments that get really big laughs that are yours.
Yeah.
And we always, when we watch the movie, we're just like, fucking Sudeikis, man. We're like, how does he know? How does he know? You know? So, I mean, and we're always.
But
we're
did you have ATV envy? At the end of the movie, I saw it last night, the whole ATV.
Oh, yeah. How about that? Yeah, it's so great. That laugh, so great. I mean, my wish if we had, extra $1 million would be that when it ramped off, that it went behind the thing, that it disappeared. So we just digitally, that thing's going on the cliff. It's more of a hill than we can see.
Yeah.
But it's still, it plays so nice. And it's like, that's one of my favorite things about the movie, is that it is comedic, and yet it is, I mean, I found it, and it's hard to speak towards it being effective with this being one of the vessels for you to buy into. That said, dramatic, like that you go back and forth here, you know, like, and that here it is, the kiss, you know, I mean, even though they've already kissed, but here's the real kiss, and the end of the movie, and then you have this, when people are hopefully like, yeah, oh, here we go, oh, good, thank goodness, you know, and that really, all of a sudden, framed so well, it's like, and that kid, what was his real name, I forget, Ethan Woodcock, he's so great.
He is.
He's so great, comes in with all that same kind of swagger that Joe has, but, it's like, he's the younger version of Joe's character, you know,
Do you know that he's now doing a Book of Mormon tour?
Oh, that's great.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, playing one of the lead elders, or, you know?
Yeah, I think he's one of the lead guys. Smile.
Yeah, like any of those, like anything that comes up, because I would challenge you to be able to figure out which ones are specifically like say mine, and the joy of that is having so many great moments already built in and being so fleshed out and so thought out. And while you know, I hope their it doesn't take them 10 more years to make their next movie. You know, you feel that all through in there. You know, and the things that get cut out that we were talking last night. You know, scenes and you know, the tiny speeches or interactions or even full like you know storylines. It's all in there. It's just a lot of it has to be removed to sort of you know give you something even more specific and appointed to sort of hang on to and emotionally take. So it's all about just coming up with the character and taking the words and then just being like, oh, this is in the style of a Sean and Desi film. And that's just something that I had a knack of just being around really funny people all my life and then even more specifically the last 10 years at SNL. Writing is, you know, all writing is rewriting. And so we're just, you know, coming up with things where, oh, this feels like this would work. Even on the day, sometimes we're like, oh, I don't think that feels like what we would say. And then it was never a debate.
No,
it was always a creative conversation.
Completely organic. Yeah. I have to give sincere props to Jason because it was kind of odd how, I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but, you know, when he was showing up on set and we were even having our first rehearsal, I remember saying to Sean, after first rehearsal, why does it seem like he's already in my brain? Like, he's read it, he's reading it, you know, how I completely imagined it, the tone of voice. Like, you remember that from the first rehearsal?
Absolutely.
It's like Jason was there.
He was there while you were, and we were writing it with me, and we were reading it back and forth. And like, she's just doing the line readings.
No, but
good punctuation. You guys know. That's the roadmap that I,
It was completely, just shows how much I feel like how much affinity Jason and Andrew, you know, had, that Jason just completely slipped into his skin in the way that I was like, this is exactly what I imagined, only better, basically.
Sean, can you talk about the trajectory from the idea for the film to getting these great actors involved?
Well, it was a really long road. It was over the course of many, many years. Desi started writing the screenplay I don't want to speak for you, but it was inspired by watching Before Sunrise and diving into Linklater, and it sort of started with two characters, Andrew and Hannah, just talking about life, talking about different ways of living your life, the city life, the country life. And then over the course of a couple of years, Desi was working in development, so on the other side of the table from a lot of writers. And it just became something that we were always talking about. I was running my own production company, so it was just sort of on the back burner. Desi was writing it, and it developed into this story. And at a certain point, I'd been in Los Angeles for 10 years, and I said, we've made a short film together and not killed each other doing it. We weren't married yet. We enjoyed that process. And I said, we got to make our first feature. Okay, this was 8 years ago. Let's go do it. You wrote this great movie set in your hometown. I love your hometown. I love all the people in it. What we'll do is we'll move to Maine. We'll bring the circus to your hometown.
We'll just sell all of our real stuff.
Sell our stuff. Sell your car. You know, dump it all and go make this movie right away.
For nothing.
For nothing. You
with
know,
no,
just
yeah,
like
with no one.
Steal money from our friends. Like, maybe some actors from New York, who knows, will come up and do it with us.
Yeah.
And, you know, the second we packed our bags and left, we got very, very fortunate because we've been working in the industry for so long. We had connections to some people who got it to this wonderful, wonderful man named John Levin. Works at CAA, and he had this great emotional connection to Maine.
He went to camp there.
Went to camp there, spent his whole life there.
People love Maine.
So many people who love Maine connected to this story and just said, this is worthy of being done on a larger scale. You should wait. Don't make it really small. Please, please, please show it to some actors. And mainly, this lead role for, you know, a wonderful female lead was something that people felt like was very valuable and that actresses would want to get their teeth into. That process is what took the majority of the time, because with a small film with a first-time director and no money, you hand off that script even though people are enthusiastic about it, and it would take 8 months to hear from the one individual that we're going after. Mm-hmm. We had some bites, and then it's funny, like we got actors attached through personal connections and friends, and then a couple years ago we were lucky enough to...
It's like three.
Was it three now?
No, I can't remember three. When I got it. Like how?
I can tell you because I have that journal.
Oh, good.
Oh, good.
You know, I got it all. But
yeah, we mugged Jason. Jason, we caught him outside.
They didn't take anything. They just stuffed a script out. The most pleasant mugging. And then some syrup.
There's
a lot of syrup.
There were pineapple sachets involved.
And whoopie pies.
No, it was just an incredible stroke of luck combined with a really wonderful and sort of heartfelt screenplay from Desi, and then me getting in the room with people and trying to convince them that I'm not a psycho killer and make a movie. You know, that
but even
probably
once
was the hardest part.
Then it's
I'm so good.
But even once we were cast, I mean, there were so many, like the goalposts were always moving forward, and I really, really hope that if we have the good fortune of making another film, or is it good fortune that some of the gaps of, you know, the waiting and the putting together the moving pieces, hopefully it will be slightly more compressed so that we don't have, like, you know, Arden is six now, and then the next time we make a film, she's in college or something like that.
At the same time, I feel like that long gestation period was incredibly valuable. Like, we had years to keep on working on the screenplay, and something you referenced last night is that there would be actors who were interested or who we were maybe targeting with the screenplay, and we'd make little revisions, specifically on the Andrew character, evolved over the course of those 8 years immensely, because we began to realize it was very much about Hannah when it started, and then we realized, all right, we got to really flesh him out. Mm-hmm. And he became, I don't know, it's funny, right before we got to show it to Jason, there was a big change in the Andrew character where he became a little bit more out there, a bigger persona, and I think it was just great. It was very fortuitous that happened before Jason read it, because there wasn't quite as much there, but so, I don't know, I think it grew and became a better film. I'd still love to have made it 8 years ago really small, and I still think it would have been wonderful, but I can't believe how lucky we are. It's a dream come true. I mean, to work with these guys, to work with Rebecca, it was, I don't
and
know,
Griffin and
I don't
Bob
know
and,
what to say. It was just, it was transcendence. It really was.
Not the
not
Rebecca
the movie.
Not,
Sean and Desi, obviously one of the big things in the film is the idea of collaboration and like how difficult it can be, especially when you're or eventually in love with your partner to actually work through all that. I'm wondering how their collaboration process compares to you guys' own.
It's just identical. A lot of resentment, really awkward silences, sexual tension, we don't know what to do with.
Memorable family dinners.
Yes. I mean, a lot of that is taken from life. Desi wrote this screenplay about her family life and her extended family in Farmington. A lot of those characters are real. There's, and that collaboration 8 years of working on this screenplay together, it was immensely challenging from time to time. We're lucky in that.
Yeah, we like each other.
Is, yeah, she's an incredibly caring and loving woman, and I'm a bastard, but she puts up
well,
with
me. Well, no, but it is like, Sean is an incredibly critical person, and this is what, it helps you do what you're doing, and you're always challenging the script. I cannot tell you how many times, like, we'd write, I'd have a scene, and you know what, like this, when I first started writing, you know, I didn't know what I was actually doing. I was working development, but I just really wanted to write something, and I was, you know, inspired by the Linklater stuff, and I, after work, was it after school? You know, after work, I'd get home, and sometimes I'd write a scene that was, you know, 4 pages long, because they were just talking, and before it was even finished, I'd be like, hey, can I read this to you? And I'd read it out loud, and I'd act it out for them. And, you know, in the beginning, because we were falling in love, you're like, that's great, keep going. And then, you know, cut to, you know, 8 years later, and I do something, and you're like, this is not funny enough, do it again. And you... There were definitely, of course there were tears, because I'm sensitive and Sean is tough.
Tears.
So many tears. But it
informs those characters too. Yeah. It informs the dynamic.
Yeah, but I never, I mean, in truth, like, I know that if you're pushing me, it's because something isn't quite there. Mm. Like, I like to feel like, okay, I wrote it and I think it's good and it's going to hold together. And like, it, just because you wrote it doesn't mean it's done. That's what you said. And our marriage, I think, is kind of cool that it's sustained the amount of, I mean, because in the cut I had to push back on you.
Yeah.
Like, we've had to,
it
works because we actually respect each other's opinion. I think that's, yeah, you know, the basis that
yeah
works.
Would you make suggestions while he was directing?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
I mean, that's the thing.
There's
really
a mind meld
filmmaking partnership.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a man, I can't have people see, like, a woman come out.
You
was really sorry.
That's going to come out great.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
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 Joke.
Just a joke.
Use the joke font for that. Yeah. Wingdings.
Do you know that our daughter is 6, and she said, doesn't this... Oh, I can't say that.
We've got very little sleep. It's best you not go.
I'll tell you later.
No,
she's 6.
No, yeah.
You can't put her in the thrusters of the press.
No, I've got to protect her a little bit.
I have a question for Diana. You actually have a tragic similarity to Hannah in the way that you had to deal with death of a friend publicly.
Yeah.
When you were reading the script, were you just like, I don't know. Were you hesitant at all?
No.
Because you're not playing them.
No.
Yeah.
And also too, like, I mean, that was an awful time, and you have, I've realized now, because, you know, I've lost people that were, you know, grandparents and things
sure
like that you process in a different way because they're of a certain age that allows you to kind of get through it.
Right.
But I guess similar to Hannah or to anybody dealing with a friend that's taken far too early, I think there's the stages that you go through, and by the time I was doing that film, I had really gone through the thick of it, to the fact that I don't think I was even registering it, you know, and then maybe a year later, things come surging back to you that you're like, oh, weird, I didn't deal with that then, and now it's, you know, or like, but I do find what's interesting is over the course of time, like, with people that I've lost in my life, there are moments where there's somebody new or somebody that you know, but most often somebody new that comes into your life and does something or says something that's so eerily reminiscent of that person.
Yeah.
And you get, you know, it's happened to me a few times with my grandmother, with Corey, with a few other people where you're just like, oh my God, and you have to like stop and kind of process it and like be so thankful for it. And I think that makes loss much easier to deal with. Yeah.
Actually, yesterday we were here with Olivia talking about Meadowlands, and that's a movie around loss. And did you guys make these films at the same time? And did you have discussions on that?
Tumbledown was first, and then Meadowlands was last summer. So Tumbledown was about a year. We finished a year ago.
Almost,
yeah,
almost
you know,
exactly.
A year and a week. And then Meadowlands last July.
Mm.
I mean, do we talk about it? No, because it's almost like to talk about it, it would almost let the air out of it a little bit. Meadowland, I made the choice to not read the script because I mean, even just watching it the other night, it's like it's heartbreaking. You don't want to see, you know, the person you love go through that, and then I'm empathizing. I mean, I lost my mind during Luke's speech talking about the kids laugh. Oh, Jesus, you know, and it's like, it's almost like, you know, the thing they say about pitchers, you know, like, you know, during a no-hitter, don't talk about it during a no-hitter. It's like, you're, when you're in the thick of it, we both had incredible creative collaborators, like everybody here, and Rebecca and Kristen on my side, thanks to her, and Reed and Luke, to air it out on there, and then capture it in between, you know, action and cut, hopefully at its strongest, and then feel in our tiny trailers as we tiny little heated rooms, basement rooms, the glamour of movie making, to like, you know, feel it within there, and then you kind of come home, and it's nice to have the reprieve and have someone that you can lean on that like that gets it without having to even say a word, you know, because they did Meadowland here, so Liv would come home every night. She spent a great deal of time, even though she was at that point 9 months pregnant, coming up to Massachusetts, and me coming back on the weekends, and it was. Yeah, it's nice that it's not, that someone that gets it without having to be given it.
Mm-hmm. Jason and Danny, you both have other films here at the festival as well. Is it interesting to have multiple babies in the process?
Yeah, I mean, you because yours is an actual premiere, mine's a screening, so I sort of felt it in front of an audience once before. But yours is, you haven't seen it with the crowd yet, right?
I haven't seen it with the crowd.
Yeah.
And I was saying earlier, I'm in every scene, every shot, every everything. Right. Oh, no. Just get a little naked in it, you know. So I'm just like really happy that my family isn't here. I can like do it step by step.
Right.
Like,
right.
Creeping into
the water. The old-fashioned like screen cap show up.
Yeah. See when you have to kind of like hold a hand up. You know? Yeah. That'll be interesting getting on the stage after for the Q&A. So how did you feel when you were naked in the sand?
I'm right.
With that,
you're
with
after,
that
right?
Snake
that
crawling over you. Yeah,
it's nice.
Yeah, I have a trip sequence. Yeah.
Whoop. This is my kind of film. We went the wrong direction and tumbled
out. I'm really proud of the fact that the two that I got to be a part of were both things that people saw something in me that you know, you can only hope to get across out of being fans and having an obsession, maybe not with musicians, but probably more with like actors, you know, like something that roles that like you know, we talked a lot about Jack Nicholson. We talked, you know, Tom Hanks always, you know, as a goal. You know, I'm not saying I am him, but like, why not shoot for someone as incredible and you know, genuine as he is? But the fact that they both would fall under romantic comedies and they couldn't be more different, and I think that's a celebration of what independent films get to do, where you get original voices and they get through with the muckety muck, maintaining that voice. And hopefully you cast it with people that you know, jive with that voice, and it still, you know, becomes harmony versus a singular voice. And so with Leslie, who wrote and directed, Leslie Headland, who had seen with other people, the other one that's on Tuesday, or the first, whatever, it's still two people, like, you know, at odds or dealing with their own issues and then sort of finding themselves throughout the whole thing. It's a story as old as you know, Adam and Eve. You know, it's like it's literally possibly the oldest story of all time. And to get to show those different sides, you know, and which is simply for me, like one with a beard, one without. and yet to just be a vessel for those voices is like...
Your process.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, it's follicle. Stanislavski, I'm Gillette. But it's like, it really is. I'm proud to get to do that. I mean, you know, to a non-discerning viewer, they may be like, oh, he's just doing the same thing. Or That's so fucking uncomplimentary to the people that wrote these things from different places with different points of view. Like, I'm just saying the words. Like, the, you know, I'm excited to sort of get people's reaction to that. And flattered to be, you know, part of Tribeca, because we live here and we love it here. And, yeah, it's been great. And I was glad to be, you know, asked both by both parties to do it.
Yeah, two people asked you to the prom and you got to say yes.
Different schools, different schools. Same school district, but luckily they fell on different nights.
Okay.
I mean, those guys, so inspiring. Just making a TV show with themselves.
So fun. Yeah.
Later.
Yeah.
We want to do photos quick. Maybe
We can line the four of you guys up again. Or let's go right.
It's like that awkward family portrait.
So once you look down, it's just tumbled down, right? Tumbled down from, that's where it landed.
Thanks, guys.
You guys are awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks for
watching
the film.
Oh, our pleasure.
Some snakes.